right, so I'm not going to give a PowerPoint talk, so don't worry. But I wanted to start out with a few general remarks. So the first thing is, before I even begin, Julie Theriault, who's going to be here for a couple weeks later this month, for 4 weeks, and Yane Kondev, who will also be here, I don't remember for how long. The three of us for the last 5 years have been working on a book called Physical Biology of the Cell. It's basically meant to be somehow a mathematical version of this tome from the Alberts guys. This is called Fat Alberts. And so what I want to do is give you a sense of why we think it's really interesting and important to try and bring physical methods to bear on biological problems. I want to say right at the outset that I'm going to give you a completely subjective and personal view. I probably have something to offend everybody. And I'm going to be guilty of exaggeration and hyperbole to make a point. And also because I personally, I can't speak for any of the rest of you, but I find seminars are generally boring, and ITP is a place where you go to hear even more seminars than usual. So I was thinking that I would try to entertain you a little bit. So with that said, I guess I wanted to say one of the great pieces of fun of being in the biology building at Caltech is it means that all the biologists get to abuse me. Because I'm a physicist, you know, that's trying to do biology, and some of them frown on that. And my friend Scott Fraser, he told me, you know, the definition of a biophysicist, it's somebody who, when he is with other physicists, talks about biology. When he's with biologists, he talks about physics. And when he's with other biophysicists, he discusses the weather. In fact, for the last 3 months, I've been making a very careful analysis of the swell, the wind direction, and the rainfall in the Indian Ocean. And in particular, this part of Indonesia, which is called the Mentawais, and El Nino is in effect. So in fact, what I want to do for starters is try and give you a sense of what I hope to accomplish with this talk. So what I want to do is, slogan that I guess I want to try and drive home is that quantitative data demands quantitative models. And that's really the upshot. Oops. Quantitative data demands quantitative models. And what I want to do is show you the kind of beautiful quantitative data that is coming forth in biology and argue why it's extremely ripe for people with physics background to think about. I also want to give you a sense of the fun that's to be had in this area, because I think, or at least I hope, most of us went into science because we thought it was fun and interesting. And then lastly, I'm going to try and provoke you with a number of outstanding challenges from this field. So the plan of attack is the following, that what I want to do is I want to basically take you through several case studies that I think are particularly opportune to try and get across this point about the existence of quantitative data. And in each of those cases, I'll try and make some little toy calculations. What I want to do is I want to emphasize data. Then I want to get a feeling for the numbers by doing simple estimates. And then I'll try to introduce some toy models that illustrate the key ideas. And then maybe, as I said before, end up with some of the key outstanding challenges. So one of the things that I wanted to say is noted at the top, and that is that I think that this is an exceedingly rich area. And the way that I think of it is that it's, in a sense, comparable to astronomy when spectrometry became available. In other words, there's all sorts of interesting quantitative things that are being done now. And in a certain sense, the argument that I want to make is that the biologists have really got all sorts of beautiful and sophisticated models. And almost arbitrarily, you can turn to a given page in this book and you can find something interesting to think about. And often these cartoons are very sophisticated and deep models. And the argument I'm going to try and make today is that now that data about gene regulation takes form in sort of this kind of quantitative way, and I'm going to elaborate on that, these cartoon level models, they really don't respond to the data in a way that we would like. Although I was going to say it at the end, I guess I'll just bring up the connection to Maxwell right now. So this book is more or less the reason that I decided to get into science. And something in the preface really caught my attention. And that was 30 years ago almost. And I just keep on looking at it. And the point is that Maxwell made these remarks about how he vowed not to look at any of the mathematical physicists' works until he had studied Faraday's experimental researches in electricity very carefully. And so he says, before I began the study of electricity, I resolved to read no mathematics on the subject till I had first read through Faraday's experimental researches. And then he gives a little bit of a discussion. And then what he says, I also like very much, and I think it's very appropriate for the situation right now. What he says is, when I had translated what I considered to be Faraday's ideas into a mathematical form, and then he goes on to say what the consequences of that were, but my basic thrust is that there's a great opportunity for physicists to translate into mathematical form some of the very interesting cartoon level models. And of course, this is something that's been going on for a long time, but I think it's ripe for further study. So, let's see. As I already said, I think this is exceedingly rich. Another thing that's very useful is that we're getting to the point where we can actually make a census of the inventory of a cell such as a bacterium like E. coli. So, the way I would put this, sort of paraphrasing Elio Schechter in the huge two-volume work on E. coli, is that cell biologists have two cells that care about, E. coli and the one they're working on. And in a certain sense, the E. coli is like the Ising model for us as physicists. It's really sort of the model system. And so what I want to do is just try and give you a few estimates, and there's a key punchline to knowing something about how many molecules are present in a cell like this. So the characteristic dimension is about 1 or 2 microns. And what this means is that the volume of the cell is of order 1 micron cubed, which is roughly 1 femtoliter. The area on the surface of the cell, which I also care about for reasons you'll see in a second, is 6 microns squared. And what I want to do is I want to try and estimate how many proteins are in a cell. And the reason that I want to do that is I want to make 2 key points. One is that the cell is a crowded place. So what I'm going to show you is that the mean spacing between proteins is of order, say, 7 or 10 nanometers. If the characteristic size of a protein is like 3 nanometers radius, that means that there's just little it's stupid to think of the cell as a solution. All right, so that's point one. And the second thing I wanted to do is, once we work out the number of proteins, then I want to argue that the cell cycle is of order 2,000 seconds. That's how long it takes for a cell to divide. You have to synthesize all these proteins in that 2,000 second time scale. And it's interesting to try and reason out, what does that mean about how fast the machines are that do that job? So that's the estimate that I want to try and make. So let's see if I can do this on the fly. So the first thing that I would say is, we want to find out what the mass of the cell is, and basically my proposal is, let's just take the density of water times the volume. So this is something like 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter times 10 to the minus 18 meters cubed, and what we get when all the dust settles is 1 picogram. All right, so that's the characteristic mass of a cell like E. coli. And now what I want to do is I want to try and get an estimate for the number of proteins. And the way that we can do this is to invoke just a fact, and the fact is that roughly 30% of the mass of the cell is macromolecular. Okay, so, and half of that roughly is protein. So what I'm going to say is that the mass of the proteins is of order 0.15 picograms. So what do I want to do? I want to say, so this is 0.15 times 10 to the minus 12 grams. Divided by 30,000 grams per mole. And so what we'll find here, I guess I should just do the math, is, so this is 15 times 10 to the minus 14 times another 10 to the minus 4. This is over 3. So I get 5 times 10 to the minus 18 grams. And then I need to multiply this by moles. Thank you. Moles. And that's right, because now I want to multiply by Avogadro's number. So 6 times 10 to the 23 molecules. I can't write over here, but per mole. And what we end up with is 3 times 10 to the 6 proteins. That's a pretty good number. Just as an aside, about a third of those are associated with the membrane, and that's the reason I cared about the 6 micron squared area. So I leave it to you to work out the mean spacing between the proteins, but it's a pretty tight place, as usual. Okay, so one of the interesting points is what this means is that if I think of my cell as a cube, then that means that there's roughly 100 proteins on a side, and this distance is of order of a micron, so the mean spacing is something like 10 nanometers, let's just say. And so my point in bringing this up is just to say that if I have two proteins represented here as blobs, they're about 3 nanometers in dimension, then that tells me, you know, that this little region right here is something like 4 nanometers. I've actually overestimated. It's really even tighter than I'm saying. So that's one interesting thing, and it's going to come back at the very end as my little story about one of the fun challenges. We learn in chemistry that the chemical potential is mu naught plus kBT log C, and that's sort of a dilute solution worldview, and yet people invoke that all the time when they're trying to think about cells, and I'll come back to that. The one other thing that I wanted to do is now let's try and estimate what happens when one of these cells actually divides. So what's the picture? So the cell starts out like this, and then over some period of time it starts to divide, and at the end we're left with two new little beasties. If this is the time axis, we're talking about roughly 2,000 seconds. So what I want to do is I want to take this 3 times 10 to the 6th number of proteins, and I want to figure out how many are synthesized per second. That's straightforward. And then that's going to tell us something about the machines that do this construction job. So dn protein by dt is of order 3 times 10 to the 6th proteins divided by 2,000 seconds. We'll just call this, 1.5 times 10 to the 3 proteins per second. And then I remind you that there's a little machine, the ribosome, the job of which is to read messenger RNA and to spit out proteins. Proteins are basically chains of amino acids. And let's take as our characteristic length of a protein something like 300 amino acids. So what do we learn? This tells us that we have 300 amino acids per protein times 1.5 times 5, sorry, times 10 to the 3 proteins per second. And so this implies that the rate is something like 5 times 10 to the 5th amino acids per second are being added on. Well, if the mean rate of a given ribosome is something like between 10 and 100, then that tells you. We've got a rough impression. There's like 10,000 ribosomes around. And in fact, people know how to do experiments where they can increase the concentration of ribosomes, these little machines, and then in turn, they can speed up the cell cycle. And so there's a nice little relationship between those two things. Okay, so that's kind of getting a feeling for the numbers. And basically, one of the themes that will be discussed quite a bit at the program on new physical approaches to molecular and cellular machines is the way that the machines mediate the processes of the cell. And in fact, we heard a very interesting talk from Watt Webb this morning. The genome of E. coli is it's 5 times 10 to the 6th base pairs long. So that means the letters in the little alphabet of A, T, G, and C, there's 5 times 10 to the 6th of those. And if you think of DNA polymerase, the little copying machine that makes a copy of the genome in the 2,000 seconds as a FedEx truck, then that means that the DNA is about a meter in size. The genome length is about 500 kilometers. And this machine travels that distance in 2,000 seconds, making an error once every 10 kilometers. So, you know, I guess I'm just trying to say, you know, it's very high fidelity, and that's also something I'm going to come back to later. I'm also going to come back to FedEx analogies in a little bit. Okay, so just to continue with this, Another thing that I wanted to say is that, I don't know, I guess I should, my wife every morning tells me before I go to work to keep my mouth shut, and I have such a hard time with that. But what I wanted to say is that sometimes I feel like that a lot of what happens in my former life in condensed matter physics had to do with going to very exotic and extreme regions of parameter space in order to see something interesting. And what I wanted to say about the stuff in that book is that you just have to, all you have to do is just go walk around on the beach or whatever and you see something interesting. In other words, it's right there for the taking. Although if you're into extremes, there's all sorts of good extreme stuff, like cells that live at very high temperatures and thermal vents and, you know, eat weird stuff and, you know, all that kind of business. But I'll leave that alone for the moment. Probably everyone's seen this quote. I don't even know if it's true, but it's fun. So what Kelvin said is, I often say that when you can measure what you're speaking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. But when you cannot express it in numbers, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind. It may be the beginning of knowledge, but you have scarcely in your thoughts advanced to the stage of science, whatever the matter may be. Just as a humorous aside, I guess, I just spent the weekend reading a really fantastic book about the age of the Earth, and Lord Kelvin really got it wrong on the subject of the age of the Earth, and he caused Darwin and others, all the geologists and the biologists, a great deal of grief. So I think it's good for the gunslinger physics types, of which I guess I might be one too, to just be careful that, you know, sometimes we talk with, I mean, if you look at what Kelvin said in his papers, he was awfully confident. He used very strong language. Yeah. And basically, I think the conclusion, you know, I'm way out of my bailiwick, this book anyway claims that that method does not work, period, not even today. There's all sorts of interesting stuff. No, but even if you include that, it's not, apparently. I mean, I can show you, we can look at it and see whether it's crap or not, but Dalrymple, who's supposedly a big shot in this area, he rejects that, sedimentation, water level. There's all these schemes that people tried over the years. Radioactivity, meaning in the form of dating, is the thing that seems to work. But anyway, I don't know, I was thinking of assigning in my class. That's how I got on the subject, and I got all interested in doing the cooling problem, but at the end of the day, the claim is it won't work, even with radioactivity. No, it won't work for getting the age of the Earth. So somehow it's too complicated. Another example is that apparently convection is very important relative to conduction, and so, you know, it's that kind of stuff. I don't know, but it's fun to think about. Yeah, you know, lots of stuff. All right, so what else should I say? It sounds like a good place to stop, but I guess I'll go on. So the experiment, now I want to tell you about these various quantitative experiments that I think are really fantastic and really illustrate the way in which people are grabbing these biological systems and manipulating them in ways that allow them to learn very quantitative things. I'll show the movie again in a second. But the experiment that basically convinced me to just throw away my former life and start over was an experiment by Carlos Bustamante's group. And I thought I had written down this is from Bustamante, but the idea is the following. What they did is they interested themselves in the lifestyles of bacterial viruses. So the idea is, I've just shown you this picture of E. coli. We already said that this is of order 1 micron. And there's these little lunar lander guys, little viruses, with a characteristic dimension of 50 nanometers. So that's this dimension. Inside of it is something like 48,000 base pair long genome, so that's 16 microns. And this genome gets ejected into the host cell. The host cell says, yeah, I know what I'm supposed to do with DNA. I'm supposed to make a copy of the DNA, and I'm supposed to make the proteins, which it does faithfully and unfortunately. Because when it makes these new proteins, they find each other in this crowded environment, make more, about 100 more of these perfect little icosahedra, and then they release an enzyme that causes the cell membrane to be broken, and they go out to repeat their deed elsewhere. So what Bustamante and company did, which was really fantastic, was They took a bead, a little polystyrene bead, and then they used molecular Velcro in order to hook these viruses onto the surface of the bead. And then they took a second bead that had the genome of interest, and they used molecular Velcro again to attach that DNA to the second bead. And then they fed these beads to this solution where they're holding on to the bead that has the viruses. And every now and then they got lucky, and the little machine that lives at the neck, at one of the vertices of the icosahedron, it would grab this piece of DNA, and it would, through consumption of ATP, it would start to reel the DNA in. And so what I'm showing you down here is measurements made by Bustamante and company. This axis is packaging rate in base pairs per second, 100 base pairs per second. This axis is percentage of genome packed. And what I want you to notice is that for the first 50%, it basically goes at sort of constant rate, 100 base pairs per second. And then slowly but surely, the motor poops out, and ultimately it stalls. A corresponding way to view that same problem is shown here, where what is plotted is the internal force in piconewtons. And that reminds me, especially with various people that think that H and C are and E are one, that in fact, the natural units of physical biology are that KT equals 4. All right. So 4 piconewton nanometers. So that's the natural units of physical biology, I would say. 4 piconewton nanometers. Notice the reason I say that is notice the axis here. This is in piconewtons. The motor stalls at about 55, 57 piconewtons, and that is a strong motor. All right? So at any rate, what they're doing here is they're basically measuring the compression of a spring, if you like. In other words, the DNA, as it's packed inside of the virus, it costs ever more to put more DNA inside. Why? I can think of many reasons, but two key ones that you might want to consider are the elasticity of the DNA. That's one thing that comes to mind. So here's the virion. So I draw it this way basically to remind you that this thing is an icosahedron. And then the DNA gets packed inside in this highly ordered fashion. And in fact, so using X-rays or electron microscopy reveals a liquid crystalline ordering of the DNA. The spacing between adjacent pieces of the DNA is of order 25 angstroms, and the diameter of DNA is about 20 angstroms. So you can see that it's very tightly packed. Okay, so we just got through saying that this dimension right here is 50 nanometers. But probably everybody in this room knows better than I do that there's a characteristic scale over which polymers are stiff, the so-called persistence length. And for DNA, it's exactly this scale. So it's 150 base pairs. So what that means, back to my beloved FedEx analogy, is imagine a FedEx truck and try and take 500 meters of the Golden Gate Bridge cable and stick it in the back of a FedEx truck. That's the right picture. All right, I did the calculation in terms of diameter, in terms of stiffness, and all that stuff. That's exactly the right picture. That's mind-blowing. All right, so you know, if you look at palm trees, they blow around a little bit in the wind, but they're stiff. They're stiff on the palm tree height scale, but they're not stiff if you make them tall enough. So the deal is that the DNA is stiff on this scale. An even more terrible thing is that the DNA is very highly negatively charged. So every 3.4 angstroms along the DNA helix, you have two more electron charges. So, yes, Meredith.
I was going to ask if single-stranded viruses have smaller capsids.
Okay. So this is a really interesting point. Generically, what I can tell you is that although there's all these classification schemes for viruses, one possible interesting scheme is those that are pressurized versus those that aren't. Those that have very tightly packed genomes and those that don't. And the simple answer, but not universal, is viruses that leave their capsid outside are pressurized. It's part of their lifestyle. the viruses we hate and that we're scared of, except for one that I think 85% of us has, namely herpes, those viruses are not tightly packed. They self-assemble without motors. These guys need motors. They need ATP consumption in order to do the packaging. So there is an interesting dimensionless parameter, which is the ratio of the genome volume to the total volume of the capsid that one can think about. Okay.
Just to comment, I'm like the Golden Gate Bridge cable.
Yeah.
Resistance length depends upon proximity to other chains and screening.
Sure. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, no, I'm willing to go along with you on that. And
it wouldn't work if it didn't, right?
Yeah. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that it's stiff on this scale at the concentrations of ions that are around, and you have to pay. And I think the area under that curve helps you understand that. In other words, the area under this curve right here is the work done, and actually if you reason it out by looking at how much of it's elastic, how much of it's charged, it all adds up in a sensible way. And I'm going to try and do an estimate of that variety. Let me show you this movie again. So what we've been doing is, so what's being shown here is single viruses were put on a microscope slide. There's a weak flow in this direction. This is a 5-minute long video sped up. And then in the solution, there's fluorescent molecules that are put in the solution, as well as molecules that trick the viruses into releasing their genomes. And basically, what you're seeing is the dynamical release of the genomes. There's some mysterious things about this that maybe somebody will notice or we can talk about later. But the main point is that I would claim that both of these, this is a packaging experiment, this is an ejection experiment, both of them are interesting to reason about. And so what I thought I'd do is just spend a couple of minutes saying a few words about how one might reason about these things quantitatively. Okay. So what I would say is that you'd want to try and make an estimate of the free energy as a function of how much of the genome is packed. And the reason that you care about that is that then you could take a derivative of this free energy with respect to length to try and compute this force curve, the buildup of resistive force. And what I'm going to claim is that this can be written as a sum of two pieces. And I'm just going to hint at how one might go about thinking about these things. So the first bit is bending, and this is going to come up again because when I talk about gene regulation. So I just remind you that if I have a piece of cable or whatever, a piece of DNA, and I think of it as mass spring system, and then I deform this into an arc of a circle, then there's this line through the middle known as the neutral axis where the length stays the same. And what that means is that these material elements are longer than they should be. Those are smaller. And if you integrate over the cross section, what you end up with is a really great result, which is that the energy of bending looks like the persistence length, kBT, over 2, and then integral 0 to L of the curvature squared ds. So that's kind of the general result. And the particular result that's of use is what happens if I have a circular hoop. And in that case, this is all really easy. And what we find, so k is going to be 1 over, this is going to be 1 over r. I square it to get the curvature squared. I integrate over the length, it's 2 pi r. And when all is said and done, the energy of a hoop is going to be given by pi times the persistence length, kT over r. All right, so that's the first thing to say. And now if I want to try and reckon the total bending energy associated with one of these configurations, what I can do is I can say the total bending energy is given by a sum over all of the hoops, n of r, where r sub n, where that is the number of hoops at a given radius. And then I'm going to have these factors. So what I'm saying is that to get the total bending energy, what I do is I figure out how many hoops there are at a given radius, and then I multiply by the energy per hoop, and I sum over all the various radii. And so the sum, I don't really know how to do. If somebody knows, I'd love to hear. But I know how to turn it into an integral, and you get a nice simple result. It won't surprise you that it's a logarithm, and you know, blah blah blah. So I don't want to go into much more detail with that. But now let's talk about the free energy associated with the charges. So there's a really beautiful experiment that was done by that guy over there, our fearless leader, Adrian, on what they did. Tell me if I get this not quite right, but here's my interpretation of it. They
may sound better than the truth.
Okay, good. Yeah, if you like it, leave me alone. All right, so here's the cool experiment as far as I understand it. So they have DNA, which is hexagonally ordered, and then they have some molecules of a polymer, which serves to make an osmotic pressure. I think maybe it was polyethylene glycol, but I don't remember. Is that all right?
There's a lot of different ones.
Okay.
You have to make sure the chemistry is boring.
Okay. It's not, though. It's good fun. All right, and then what they did, again, you got to set me straight if I'm not right on this, but what they did is they tuned the concentration of PEG. That serves to squish on the lattice of DNA, and then they shine X-rays in order to measure the de-spacing. And what they get out of that is an equation of state that tells them the relationship between the pressure and the spacing of the DNA. And the equation of state looks like this, where D is the mean distance between the centers of these guys in the hexagonal array. Did I do all right? I passed? Okay. Okay, yeah, I like squish too. So what we did, I'm not going to really comment on any further, but you can, if you pretend that the lattice of DNAs is described by a pair potential, you can invert this relation from their experiment and work out what the pair interaction is as a result of the charges. And the reason I like that is that it includes a lot of stuff about the interaction that we don't know. In other words, I could use Poisson-Boltzmann to try and handle parts of the charge interaction. It doesn't work very well. And so the bottom line is we took sort of an empirical worldview, appealed to their experiments, worked out what the parapotential is, and then when all is said and done, you can work out the free energy of interaction, and you can compute stuff like how does the rate of ejection depend on the genome length. So just to give you, yeah.
So can you figure out what bits that are missing, let's say, from Poisson-Boltzmann?
Yeah, so what you're missing, for example, is you're missing the hydration effects, you know, stuff going on with the water, and you know, there's all sorts of things that I think that are missing in that treatment. So let's see, the other thing is that sometimes we care about guys with charge 3 or 4, spermine and putrescine and all these things, and I think it's hopeless in those cases, but... Yeah. So again, we just adopted that worldview. Okay, totally different case, and no matter what, I'll stop at 10 after 1, so there's time to talk or leave or whatever, and also in keeping with my scheme that seminars are boring. So let's see here. So the second case study that I wanted to tell you about has to do with gene regulation. And there's a lot in here, so let me just attempt to give you the lowdown in sort of oversimplified terms. And I confess to, you know, exaggerating things and not telling you all the little details. So, you know, if you want to pursue them, just let me know. But the basic idea, here I'm drawing a piece of DNA, and there's some region, which is the gene of interest, and there's some start place where a particular molecular machine known as RNA polymerase arrives and makes a copy of the DNA to a messenger RNA. That's all that we really need to know at the moment. And what I want to say is that there are watchdogs. There are watchdog molecules known as repressors. And these repressors can occupy the same real estate and close that gene down for business. All right, so that's the rough idea. And so what I guess I want to say is that there's some really brilliant, tedious measurements that were made on real cells and that are plotted right here, and I want to walk you through the logic of this. And so the first point is, how do you measure gene expression? Well, one of the tricks is shown here, which is that you can couple the gene you're interested in to some fluorescent reporter, and then you measure how much of that fluorescent reporter is around, and then that tells you how much your gene of interest is on. All right, so that's what pictures like this are meant to represent. And this is a plot of the corresponding change in the activity as a function of a dose of a certain sugar. And so what's fantastic about this experiment is the following. What these guys did is they thought about a particular watchdog molecule known as lac repressor that, like the one I drew here, binds at two places on the DNA simultaneously. That means it loops out the intervening DNA. So notice the little cartoon in the bottom left. The repressor is grabbed over here, it's grabbed over there, it's looped out something like 100 base pairs in between. And now the point that I want to make sure that you're with me on, that I find amazing, is that, so what's being plotted? This is, think of this axis as how much the gene is on, and actually that's how much the gene is off, but forget it. This axis is really the interesting part. This is the length of this loop, measured in units of base pairs. The way this measurement is done is by looking at a bunch of, a population of cells. And this is completely reproducible. So for the people that like macroscopic quantum effects and all that stuff, you know, again, exaggeration, but just an angstrom, a 3.4 angstrom change in the length of a piece of DNA, or actually let's say 15 angstrom, change in the length of DNA leads to more than 100-fold change in the behavior of a population of cells. So there's two key things that I want you to notice about this. The first and most obvious one is the periodicity. So, what's the periodicity about? Imagine your three-pronged plug and its female partner. If you want to plug them into each other, you need to be properly aligned. Remember that DNA is a double helix, and the periodicity of the helix is about 10.5 base pairs. The repressor molecule has two places it likes to grab. If I change the length by 5 base pairs, I've essentially taken the place that the repressor wants to grab, and I've turned it to the exact wrong side of the DNA. So what you're seeing there is the cost associated with twisting and untwisting the DNA in order to get the repressor to bind. So basically, that's a macroscopic. So, you know, if you're being silly, you could say that this is a fancy and weird way to do a DNA mechanics experiment. You're actually seeing the twist rigidity reveal itself macroscopically. The other point, which I find equally interesting, is I want you to notice where the maximum is. The maximum is at 70.5 base pairs. But we know that the persistence length of DNA is 150 base pairs. And what I'm going to try to argue is that the maximum in repression, it's proportional to e to the minus beta free energy of the loop. So what that means is you get best repression when the looping free energy is lowest. But I just got through saying a little while ago that we all thought that the persistence length was 150 base pairs. This in vivo experiment is telling us the easiest loop to make is at 70.5. And this is a little drama that's played out again and again and again for many different systems. Messages that our understanding of in vitro DNA mechanics, which there's all sorts of cool experiments on, does not jibe with what we know about in vivo behavior. So let me just take a minute to say something about what's the physics of this F loop. All right, so here again, just a little toy calculation. So what's the logic? What I want to do is I want to compute the free energy of looping as a function of the number of base pairs. This is going to have an energetic piece. And then it's also going to have an entropic piece. We already said that this guy looks like a constant over the number of base pairs. Why? Because remember, I worked out that the energy goes like 1 over r, so it goes like 1 over the number of base pairs. So let's only think about this one.
Do you include the effect of crowding in the bending?
No, I don't. That's exactly the kind of fun stuff that one should include. And so the simplest explanation for this is that there are other proteins around that are bending the DNA and doing like you say. The only thing that's odd about that is that we can take the free energy we extract from the lac repressor system, go plug it into the in vivo experiments for ERA-C, a totally different case, and it really matches up nicely. In other words, that's just kind of odd. In other words, you might think there were different attendant proteins in those two cases. Anyway, I don't know. It's early, too early to say. So how do we estimate the looping?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Is there also a bending piece of the repressor itself?
Ah, that's a really interesting question. And I guess the current thinking is that there's two states, actually, for the repressor. And you can include that easily. It's not going to cure this problem, though. What it's going to lead to is, if you look carefully, these shoulders. So that's something that Jose Villar actually has been thinking about lately. I think that that's the more likely outcome of the flexibility of the protein. Okay, so I guess I wanted to make just a word of warning. So I'm going to do the stupidest calculation that I can think of, which is fun and interesting and probably right for my grade level. But if you really are serious about this, then you use the worm-like chain and you do a path integral and all that kind of stuff. My punchline will not be changed. You can do the calculation any old way you want. If you use a linear elastic model of DNA, you will not get
a maximum of
70 base pairs. All right, so I'm just going to try and emphasize what goes on here. So what I'm going to say is that S of n base pairs is going to be KB log, well, let me call it actually delta S, log of number of looped configurations over the total number of configurations. And let me do a one-dimensional case. So I don't know how to draw it very well, but so that's a loop.
So this is
initial. Here's final. And what do we know about a loop in one dimension? That the number of right steps and the number of left steps better be equal. And so that means that the number of looped configurations is n factorial over n over 2 factorial twice downstairs. So if you grind through this using Stirling, so you have n over e to the nth power root 2 pi n, and then downstairs n over 2e to the n, 2 pi n over 2 to the n over, I guess this is just like that. When all the dust settles, what you find is root pi over 2n. Okay, sorry, I switched between n base pairs and capital N. Hopefully you'll forgive me. So now I can compute the entropy. Yes? Good. You are fast. I like that. Excellent. You're right. Now it's okay. You're right. Good. I like that very much. So, I mean, as long as we're on the topic, too, somebody in the room will have some clear and smart thing to tell me, but the first time I tried it out, I didn't include the correction, and it didn't work right. And then all my told me, of course, it didn't work right. But what bugged me about it was just I didn't have a good sense of what I'd missed. Anyway, okay. So what do we learn? We learn that this term looks like one half in the case. Well, let me just say, in three dimensions, it's 3/2 kT log of number of base pairs. And if I plot this thing, so here's n base pairs. This is free energy. It does something like this, and this is of order 500 to 1,000, something like that. Okay, the slop has to do with which model you use and so on, but again, it's very far away from the 70.5 maximum. Okay, I don't want to pursue that case study anymore, and I'm not going to do any more real calculations. I just want to show you a few other fun examples. So This is the work that Julie Terrio has been doing. What you see is a pathogenic bacterium known as Listeria. What's really fantastic about these bacteria is that they come into a cell and, like a virus, they hijack it. They basically make the cytoskeletal machinery of the cell make actin comet tails behind the bacterium, and that's what propels them around. And I'm showing you this data just to tell you that you can do interesting things like vary the temperature and measure the speed. One can measure the force generation by using all sorts of clever single molecule experiments. There's lots of data, both in vitro and in vivo, and I think it's very compelling. I also wanted to show this case study, which is a little bit different, but it's mainly for the people that like geometry in the room. So I remind you that cells have all these different compartments. And one of the most interesting compartments and the most beautiful is the organelle known as the mitochondria. With the advent of cryo-electron microscopy, so this is basically super low temperature 3D reconstructions, it's been possible to actually work out what the structure of the membranes are in these systems. And all that I really want you to take away from this is that in a system like the mitochondria, depending upon the oxidative state, one gets reproducibly but very different structures. So this is a lamellar structure, which is quite interesting. This is really like a series of interpenetrating cylinders, like a plumber's nightmare type structure. This is like a bunch of concentric spheres. Seymour Benzer finds these interesting swirls, and this is a mitochondrial myopathy where the mitochondria don't work right and basically they butt off into a bunch of little vesicles. So I guess what I want to say is that, and again, this goes back to Watt Webb's talk, is there's all sorts of interesting and rich things that one might want to do with respect to membrane mechanics in vivo. Okay, so that really kind of concludes my case study. So I just have a few more slides and then I'm done. So what I wanted to say here is, once again, I just want to hammer home my sort of central statement, which is quantitative data demands quantitative models. And I guess, you know, being a little bit obnoxious, I'd say we're fighting for the soul of theory and biology, and I mean it in the following sense. So the NSF recently convened this meeting where they basically had all the sort of the condensed matter theory types go to Arizona to talk about how to handle the future of funding for those that were moving from condensed matter to biophysics. And what I found to be the most stark and amazing fact of the whole meeting was that there was a representative of the NIH there, and his view, honestly, I'm not even making this up, was that basically the David Nelsons of the world should write code, go hang out in labs of biology groups and write codes. And so what I wanted to say here is really kind of involved with these two things. So I think it's very important. Theory does not mean simulation, and it does not mean computation. And in a certain sense, I feel like what's happened is people are trying to design Boeing 777 wings with big computational fluid dynamics codes before they even know what the two-dimensional flow over an airfoil is. But you know, that's just my take on it. But I find it, you know, very frustrating that theory has come to mean simulation and computation. I've already made my little remark about cartoon-level models. Another sense in which I think we're fighting for the soul of theory has to do with the use of the word wrong. So lots of times, biology friends of mine will make remarks about a given model being wrong. And what I think of is that when I think about the Einstein model for the specific heat, I don't know, maybe you guys think of that as wrong, but I don't. I think of it as great. And you know, we could go on and on, the Lorentz model for optical absorption. And the list is sort of endless of models that we know and love that are useful, that suggest new experiments, and so on, that if somebody wanted to, could say they're wrong. So again, I think it's up to us to try and make rock solid predictions and show that they lead to new experiments. And, you know,
what is the level of detail
of
quantum field achieved? Okay.
Do you want to hear what Borges says to say on Landau theory? So, please let me read this. This is a story. This is all there is to it, and it's so bitchin'. I can't believe it. In that empire, the art of cartography attained such perfection that the map of a single province occupied the entirety of a city, and the map of the empire the entirety of a province. In time, those unconscionable maps no longer satisfied, and the cartographer's guild struck a map of the empire whose size was that of the empire, and which coincided point for point with it. The following generations, who were not so fond of the study of cartography as their forebears had been, saw that that vast map was useless, and not without some pitilessness was it that they delivered it up to the inclemencies of sun and winters. In the deserts of the West, still today, there are tattered ruins of that map, inhabited by animals and beggars. In all the land, there is no other relic of the discipline of geography. So, that tells you what I think about the answer to your question. So I guess,
we throw around words like terabytes routinely, and I just, actually, it was at ITP,
Fareed Abraham is the one who showed me this picture first, and I've used it ever since, although I think I'm using it exactly the way he wouldn't want me to. This is the meaning of various words that we throw around in our vocabularies, and I guess, you know, I just want to say myself, I'm highly offended by the idea of terabytes worth of data, and terabytes, you know, somehow the quality of that information is pretty low, given that the Caltech Millikan Library, based on any decent estimate, is about 2 terabytes worth of data. So I think that David's point is a good one, and that's the whole point about this wrongness. So I think the more urgent wrongness to worry about is the poly not even wrong.
Isn't there a deeper question here that you both just touched on? I mean, physicists used to distinguish between the laws of physics on one hand and what Wigner called the initial conditions. And so, from that perspective, the question arises, will this field, physicists moving in this field, will there ever be new physics? Or will there be just lots and lots of more initial conditions?
Good. I'm glad you brought that up. This is a minority view, but what I would say is, just for example, thinking about non-equilibrium and not just caving in to impotence and just saying, okay, well, thermodynamics is about equilibria only. I think the bottom line is that thinking about non-equilibrium, hopefully that will deliver some new physics. I guess my first 2 points are crowding, altered kinetics and equilibria. How we think about non-dilute solutions and out systems, the kinetics in these cases. So here's a cartoon from Good Cell. It tries to represent in realistic form the crowding in a cell. You know, all the usual stuff that I learned anyway about materials being homogeneous and dilute and all that, it's not very useful for these kinds of things. I think Hockfield's example of kinetic proofreading is a specific case of a very deep idea, which is beating the delta G limit. What I mean by that is if you work out the ratio of error to correct, what you'll find is that it basically goes like, if you take the log of that error rate and multiply it by kt, that gives you the delta Gs. And basically, thermodynamics is just not good enough for biology. And so the idea of beating delta G, I think, is a place where one might have interesting stuff. I know that condensed matter types like reduced dimensionality, and one of the things that Bruce Alberts has told me many times is that tethering is something that happens all the time in cells. So that somehow taking advantage of reduced dimensionality, I think, is very useful. And so I guess one other point I wanted to make here as far as sort of outstanding challenges is just the idea of rejecting the bizarre notion that somehow physics is not allowed to comment on living matter. I don't know where that came from, but I don't like it very much. So I guess I'll just close with recommending this article from Joel Cohen at Rockefeller. It's really a fun article. I think the title is the best part, and I think actually that it's pertinent for us as well. So what he says is mathematics is biology's next microscope, only better. The more important one, I think, for us is biology is mathematics' next physics, only better. And what he's trying to tell us is that biology is going to enrich mathematics. And my point, really, the whole point of this this rant is just to say that I think that biology is totally poised to enrich physics. I mean, to me, that's a given. So on that note, I'll stop and people can do whatever.
Okay, so we have time for questions. What would you say is the since you're beating the drum for kinetic biology, that these two points, what is the example of the most successful quantitative model that has really scored well?
Well, I guess there's quite a few of them, actually, but in a certain sense, maybe Hodgkin-Huxley would have to be the the leading candidate. That's basically a treatment of how action potentials move themselves. When I talked to David Botstein and actually a few other people, so this book that we're working on, basically the way we've organized it, I promise this is pertinent to your question, but every chapter is supposed to be a hydrogen atom applicable to biology. And so I've asked a lot of people, you know, what's the hydrogen atom of that topic in biology? And more than one biologist has told me that the single best thing that came out of theory was Hopfield's kinetic proofreading. They really liked that. They thought that was a fantastic example. I mean, I wouldn't mind hearing other people's take on it, but perhaps the best of all is thermophysical chemistry and thermodynamics. I mean, STAT-MEC is used all the time for all sorts of examples.
I was just thinking of a success. The biologists might be long going to be really convinced.
I totally agree with what you're saying. So that's why I was saying what I think is needed is put your head on the chopping block level predictions. No wiggle room, no free parameters. This is what I think will happen if you do that experiment. And then that hopefully some of the time, enough of the time, you'll be right so that it's enriching. I mean, that's the sense in which I would say. But I think this virus case, you know, I don't want to, this is the ones that I know, but the virus case works really nicely, and some of the gene regulation business works really nicely. I don't know. Those are a few thoughts.
Are the biologists convinced as we are what you were saying about the level of description that the less the better?
No. And furthermore, the another thing that they would, some people would say, I mean, that I don't think there is any one general biologist, just like there's not one physicist. But another thing that could happen is
Anders. Ted Anders, okay.
Well, he's, you know,
Is he convinced?
Yes, he is. He for sure is convinced, and that's why there's this report, Bio 2010, which the National Academy's put out about the future of education and biology, and it completely is committed to the idea that this subject has to be quantitative from here on in, and you can't choose it as a field to hide from math anymore.
Yes, but you're mentioning quantitative, maybe simulations and computer analysis, and for a lot, many biologists that haven't encountered, indeed, they would like, you know, data analysis and the simulations,
sure,
and mining in databases. And
yeah. Well, so, you know, again, I'm kind of being a jerk, but I like to think of it a bit like astronomy at the time of Tycho Brahe. You know, you have this very complicated, extremely good data on retrograde motion. It's very complicated until viewed sort of in the right way. And so data mining is fine, I think, but it's no substitute for ideas and understanding. But, you know, I that's my personal view. I mean, there's very useful things to be done computationally. The other thing I would say is that, yes, a lot of the stuff that I just talked about, biologists at the end would say, you know, we already knew that. We already knew the DNA loops, and who cares if the maximum is at 70.5? That's fine. I mean, you know, some people like broccoli, others like Brussels sprouts.
So the biologists have digested what's in the Creek model, which was the field of physics and chemistry, right?
Yeah.
And they very readily forget about these things, like businessmen forget where they take electricity, say, from a plug.
Yeah.
Okay.